If we are really concerned with religion in its depth, we can never overemphasize the necessity to renounce all worldliness. The religious life, in the profound sense, cannot be led in terms of worldliness. Worldliness and transcendence do not mix. Transcendence completely suffuses the world and is over and above and beyond it. The world cannot compel transcendence, but transcendence ultimately absorbs the whole world, and all worldliness changes, transforms in the process into something utterly pure. We can live the conventionally religious life and still be worldly. We can have certain noble ambitions, altruistic activities, and all that kind of thing, and yet be worldly. Conventionally religious, and yet be worldly. But if we are concerned with something deeper, something which really touches the fruition of each individual human being into complete and perfect manhood, then each one of us must see for himself, unmistakably see, that worldliness has to be completely renounced. Renunciation here does not mean casting away, but transforming. Where is this worldliness? Within my own self. My consciousness of myself and my environment is the root of my worldliness. I can't throw away my consciousness. I can't get rid of it. I can only transform it. Even further, I can only let it get transformed by my removing the obstacles and the difficulties. Now, in practice, this renunciation comes about through the relinquishment of all that we can relinquish. All that is unnecessary for this transcendent realization must be dropped. Just dropped. When one really sees that this is unnecessary for this transcendent realization, then it drops off by itself. Like the scab which forms on the skin after the wound has healed, then the scab just drops off by itself. You could, of course, also push it off. I'm putting it in this form to suggest what is the constructive, the creative way of releasing oneself through relinquishment of all that is unnecessary. Now, as we saw last time, and as we have seen often, mindfulness and the basic moralities are absolutely indispensable. Last time we considered harmlessness. And you remember we had quite a long meditation in this connection, sort of a meditation in this connection. Today, let us consider something else which is of fundamental importance where the moralities are concerned. The whole question of sense indulgence. You may ask, why this extraordinary stress, this almost harshly ascetic sounding emphasis upon the moralities? I'll tell you quite simply why. This individual person called a man is still not fully man. He is sub-man. He is in a state of conflict. The animal with its natural drives in him, ingrained in the body, is in conflict with the aspiration that has come out of his inner psycho-spiritual life. The aspiration to transcendence. Now, in order that this person may become fully man and thereby a pure nexus for the inflow and outflow of transcendence continuously, he must be free of all that holds him back from that. Now, what holds him back is worldliness. And the principal forces which maintain worldliness and the state of disharmony and conflict are the sense indulgences. And by that I mean not only the indulgence of the senses of sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell, but also the indulgences of the mind, as we ordinarily know mind. They take the form of aesthetic indulgence, intellectual indulgence. Just as greed, ambition, envy, resentment, and all the terrible things can find expression through our ordinary so-called physical senses, they find even profounder, even more evil expression through the mind, what we commonly call the mind, the discursive mind. And this includes within the sphere of its activities all our art, science, philosophy. It's a strange thing to say, but there it is. The whole of our life in the world belongs to the realm of the mortal, belongs to the realm for us humans of conflict, of the possibility of deliberate evil. Deliberate evil as such does not exist on this planet anyway outside human deliberate evil. So all this lies within this sphere. Transcendence is that something which is waiting its emergence when all the obstructions are out. And the most powerful influence for the maintenance of these obstructions is the indulgence of the senses. You will find that every single great spiritual teacher has laid this down. In the past, Today it's the same. And in the future it will be the same. Let us consider very carefully what is meant by sense indulgence. The senses are our only windows upon the world for apprehending the world in which we live. Otherwise, we'd spend our whole life sleeping, inertly sleeping, like stones. If a sledgehammer was directed at us as stones, the stone would just break up. If wind and water and other forces acted upon us, they would wear away the stone. That's all. If we were completely sleeping, completely asleep. But the senses are the windows, the avenues through which we receive stimuli from the outer world. And the brain is the instrument, the physical instrument, by means of which these stimuli are coordinated and given a pattern, a meaning, and a significance. The brain does all that part of it. That is the mechanics of the situation. But there is another factor. Our desire, our personal desire, the feeling of wanting this, that, or the other, to do this, that, or the other, to live this way or that way. All that comes from within ourselves. Our psychical being, our psychical energy expresses itself partially as our desires. And the instruments which our desires can use are the sense impressions and the knowledge which we have gathered in the world, of things in the world, of people in the world, of living in the world. Now, all the teachers have taught that the senses must be purified, that one must use the senses to the full. Use the senses. This is the important point. The senses are our tools, our servants. Tools and servants which are not outside ourselves in this case. They are part and parcel of our own being. All right. So, we must use them to the full, perfectly. When we use our sense of sight, see. See completely, not partially. See exactly what is. When you hear, hear exactly what is, and so forth and so forth. This can be trained and developed so that the senses are absolutely perfect instruments, well tuned, like perfect instruments in an orchestra, well tuned. This is important. But now, in utilizing the senses, one or the other type of sensation is experienced, painful or pleasant. Occasionally, one is in that neutral state. It's neither painful nor pleasant. But in practically 999 out of 1,000 cases, the sensation is either pleasant or unpleasant. Out of ignorance, we desire to repeat the pleasant sensation to avoid the unpleasant sensation. If we were confined to purely biological, physical existence and its continuance, then obviously the pleasure-pain response is the only means we have for our continuance. But we are not merely that, we are something more. And that something more happens in the human species to preponderate tremendously over the pure pleasure-pain bodily reaction. This psycho-spiritual part of us. Now, because of these two reactions and our tendency to choose the pleasurable against the painful, we remain in the worldly state being dominated by our senses. And the wanting to repeat the pleasurable is the sense indulgence. Note carefully the difference between what inevitably comes to us from the world in terms of pleasure pain and our wanting to repeat pleasure and avoid pain. We cannot do anything about the fact that there is a wonderful sunset or a lovely view or whatever it is. And that, of course, is a source of deep pleasure. Use the sense of sight. You experience the pleasure. You live through it without grasping it, without wanting to repeat it. Then there is no indulgence. You see something terrible taking place in front of you, and you see it completely without experiencing aversion, resentment at it. And therefore you remain free in your inner consciousness. Both of them are indulgences. People whose natures have become perverted, ugly, distorted, delight in the terrible and the horrible and the painful, just as what those whom we call normal people will delight in the pleasurable. So you see, indulgence comes in because of the activity of our desire nature in relation to our experience. Both ways. Either in terms of grasping because of the pleasure aspect, or in terms of resentment and casting it away because of the of aversion because of the unpleasant aspect. So no sense indulgence is required if one is to live the religious life in the real sense. The full use of the senses, the complete freedom from indulgence. Now this necessitates intense mindfulness. And we do it unconsciously. We sort of do it by force of habit. Oh, that was nice. I'll have another spoon. Thank you. We are always having this other spoon. Oh, that is horrible. Be careful. Get away from it. Keep away from it. So I'm shutting out life. But I cannot shut out life. This which is called me, bears my name and all the rest of it, is completely interrelated with life in its totality. Every effort to shut out, deliberately to shut out, out of repulsion, out of dislike, only leaves me hurt, in a state of conflict, a state of violence seething inside. Now you see what an immense amount of intelligence is required here. What an extraordinary alertness, a wide awakeness. And that alertness and wide awakeness has to be an unanxious alertness and wide awakeness. If it is anxious, it means that I, the separate individual, am seeking a result. And only if I am self-oriented, self-centered, can I seek a result. If I am not self-centered, really not self-centered, I never seek a result. Result is unto the totality, not unto me. Result, whatever it be, actually affects the totality all the time. Out of my ignorance, I tend to compartment it. And in that, I remain enclosed in a state of folly. How can there be transcendence under such circumstances? The animal urge within the organism is so powerful that one unconsciously seeks the pleasurable. So we have to be watchful here. I'm not going to say be on guard, because that is an attitude of conflict, not of understanding. No war has ever resolved disharmony into harmony. No conflict does it. Only understanding, only complete openness to anything and everything does it. And in the practice of that total and complete openness, one is allowing the whole psychophysical organism to be so transformed that the power of transcendence finds less and less obstacle in this organism, physically as well as psychically. Sense indulgence is the key in terms of daily physical living. The freedom from it means the easier realization of transcendence. There is another aspect which we must always remember. If the intellectual side of us, appreciating the idea of the transcendent, but dominated by desire to achieve the transcendent, comes into play, then it intensifies both the good and the evil in us all the time. This we have talked about before also. That is why I always say to people, keep away from religion. Religion in its depths, unless you mean business. No false allegiances to the Supreme. It is not the Supreme who will punish or hurt. It is oneself who will disrupt because of false allegiance. The Supreme does not ask for allegiance from anybody or anything. It has no need to. Its supremacy is absolute and totally unautocratic. This is something we don't know at all, because our life and growth has been so colored, so poor
that we have hardly any glimpse of the light of reality.
If, let me use the word God, it's convenient to use, if God were the autocrat that he is thought by so many millions to be, he would manifest impatience. Like Hitler's, his patience would be exhausted. You see? There is a suggestion in the Old Testament when he sent the flood that his patience was exhausted. But when his patience was exhausted and he sent the flood, supposing we take the story at face value, what happened? He discovered his impotence. This omnipotent Lord was unable to do the job. You see, these are all just human concepts. The concepts of human beings who have not really penetrated into reality. So they wrote it in that form, presented it in that form. Which also has its meaning and usefulness and significance. We won't deny that. But there is something better. We can put it somewhere nearer the truth. So you see, if there is anxiety, it means that there is the longing for achievement, for attainment. And if there is the longing for achievement and attainment where the transcendence is concerned, all the unknown energies that we liberate out of our own being will intensify both the good and the evil and make the matter worse, make the situation worse. The conflict becomes greater. How then shall this allegiance be utterly pure, utterly selfless, through the moralities and the mindfulness? You see, when oneself has become clean, one is healthy in the real sense. One becomes, so to say, almost infinitely capable. This psychophysical instrument acting, shall I say, like a condenser, can take an infinite electrical charge into it. The power of the divine can flow through without cracking the instrument. Then you will know bliss, as you never knew before. You will know what the Buddha called unshakable freedom of mind, which is always associated with this blissful condition. This condition of bliss, which is utterly imperturbable, upekkha, the complete harmony, the complete integration, where the balancing needs no effort. And then also you will know what love means. Then love will be a power to heal. Not directed willfully, deliberately, but everlastingly just flowing through you. What comes from the sun? Light and heat. Constantly. It just doesn't stop. Everlastingly that light and heat comes. When you yourself are like the sun in your own soul, then love and wisdom will just everlastingly flow. It's impossible for it to be otherwise. But the life has to be free of sense indulgence. Take one or two trite examples in our daily life, which are evidence of the way in which the animal drives act in us, the greed, the possessiveness, and all the rest of it. Let me think. All right. Supposing a letter comes from the tax inspector. You have underpaid your tax by so much for this year. And he makes his suggestions as to how it shall be fully paid. Partly to convenience you, partly to convenience his job. What is the immediate reaction in one's mind? Oh no, I've fully paid it up. I'm not going to give this to him. You see? Immediately there is an emotional, self-oriented, possessive urge. There may be resentment. What's this foolish fellow up to? I've surely paid all my taxes correctly. It's done through my accountant, who has done my business for me for the last 50 years, perfectly correctly. You see? Greed, resentment, everything just springs up naturally by itself. Or, consider another situation, an actual situation which has recently occurred. This terrible disaster in East Pakistan. And the BBC gives out the news and it states certain things which represent the information it has received. That such and such a government has helped, or offered help, and the such and such a government has done nothing about it, and so forth and so forth. We need not mention names, but these are the facts. You know it all because you have been listening to this, I expect, on the BBC. What is one's reaction? That such and such a government didn't take the proper steps, although it received warning and all the rest of it. What is one's reaction? Immediately. Reaction of condemnation, of hatred, of annoyance, of anger, and all the rest of it. But what is that due to? Inside me, myself. If I were free of all self, of all sense indulgence, there would be no such reaction at all. One might ask, why do you relate it to sense indulgence? What has the indulgence of my senses, say, if I like music and I indulge myself by going to 3 concerts every day, and so forth. What has that got to do with this reaction of righteous indignation against the government which has failed to do its duty? The factors involved are my capacity for possessiveness and resentment if I am deprived of what I want to possess. You see, it's both simple and subtle. Every manifestation of whatsoever brings disharmony is directly rooted in sense indulgence. If you go right down into the roots, you will find self-sense indulgence there. If we can see this, or even see
a goodly portion of the truth of this, then we will appreciate why the Buddha, particularly amongst all the great teachers, constantly talked about the pleasures of the senses and showed how they bind the man. As long as there is this giving in to the pleasures of the senses, which is quite different from the happiness which comes to us through the right use of the senses, the inevitable right use of the senses, that it is this indulgence in the pleasures of the senses which keeps us bound. It prevents the mind and our mental energy from being free of all clutter. Clutter in the shape of particular ideas, beliefs, thoughts, and all the rest of it. Because of this, that extraordinary state which is called the emptiness of the mind cannot prevail. If senses and desire no longer obstruct, the mind at last becomes empty of all this useless clutter, this worldliness. This empty mind means that the organism is in complete tune with what the Hindus and the Buddhists called akasha, mind space. This mind space is quite unlike our physical space, which we experience through the senses. It has no dimensions, no length, no breadth, no depth. It is not a container. In the physical sense of the term container. In the physical sense of the term container, we have limitation, restriction, finitude, beginning, proceeding, and ending, which means birth, death, mortality, sin and suffering, and all the rest of it comes in. But this, which is dimensionless, is not a container in the physical sense. It is, if you like, the contained as well as a container in a transcendent sense. If any one of you has gone deeply into the Kabbalah and experienced certain things in the Kabbalah, you will know exactly what I mean. This mind space, akasha, which in Buddhism is acknowledged side by side with nirvana as an absolute. It is not caused by nature or karma. It exists on its own. This mind space. This mind space is this energy of an order which transcends all that we know of energy in the natural universe. Measurable energy, electrical, heat energy, chemical energy, etc., etc. It's quite other than that. But it is a real energy. Otherwise, no human beings could ever have gone through those experiences which completely defy all ordinary intellectual analysis, but which nevertheless are real experiences because the person is changed and transformed in the world. This is the point, and it's not an easy point to appreciate. However, we'll try. Now this dimensionless akasha, pure mind, mind only, as Mahayana talks of it, Mahayana Buddhism, mind only, is that with which the ordinary psychophysical being gets into perfect harmony.
When he is like that, he is the unresisting, completely transparent nexus for the inflow and outflow of transcendence. The Upanishads have talked of transcendence in a way which is really unique to the Upanishads. And yet they put it in a sentence so simple that it defeats the mind, the intellect. Transcendence is that from which speech and mind, referring to this akasha, this mind only, return, not having attained. Not having attained. But if the reality of that transcendence were not there, then the statements which you find, for instance, in the Mandukya Upanishad, transcendence is that with which there can be no dealing. But that is discovered by going into what they called the fourth state. Totally beyond all that is knowable. And then coming back to ordinary limited consciousness, thought and speech, or what we call mind, all start up again and somehow know that this thing has happened. Cannot be known whilst it is happening. That is why those statements about this fourth state in the Mandukya Upanishad. The Buddha merely talked, it is a tremendous merely, it's an infinite merely. The Buddha talked of the cessation. The cessation of perception and feeling. He taught about the complete dissolution of all that belongs to the mortal realm. Shape, appearance, sensation, thoughts, ideas, patterns, systems of philosophy and all the rest of it, and consciousness itself, this discriminative consciousness. And he also mentioned that consciousness which was endless, invisible, without characteristics, everywhere shining, everywhere accessible. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabham. Now you see, these great teachers were not intellectualists. They were geniuses intellectually. And over and above their intellectual genius, they had complete insight because of the activity, not of sense and discursive intellect, but of the completely empty mind. Now I'm saying this not to offer arguments or evidence, and certainly not
to try to convince you that there is this reality of transcendence. It won't matter at all whether you see it at the moment or don't see it, whether you have your own conceptions of it or anything at all. The fact is that throughout our life this operates. And if we are to grow into the fullness, which is the Son of Man become the Son of God, to use Christian terminology, if we are to operate in our fullness, then our task is to be free of these obstructions. See how easily one can be deluded. And therefore seduced into sense indulgence. A modern problem in the world is drug taking. Drug takers come along to one who is trying to tread the path and put it to him, how can you know about this unless you yourself experience what happens when you take these drugs and you have a trip, go into transcendent states, as they call them? They haven't begun to know the meaning of the word transcendent. Some of them can't even spell it correctly. You see? All right. So the one who is trying to tread the path, ultimately, he says, yes, this is logical. This is reasonable. And he says, right, I will take a drug once, twice, thrice, whatever, find out for myself, and then I'll be better fitted to help him. All right. Now I'm going to put two other situations to consider. Do I need to go out and commit murder in order to be better fitted to help murderers? Do I need to jump over a 2,000-foot precipice in order to be better fitted to help suicidal maniacs? No. What do our friends, the drug takers and company, have to say to all that? Obviously nonsensical, isn't it? But this is what happens, and look at the tragedy of it. If one sees into evil because of insight, the insight born of purity within oneself, then one can help the evildoer. Not by participating in evil. So, this participation in evil, under the excuse that, oh, I will just indulge a little bit and I'll be the better able to help the evildoer, is actually being seduced into sense indulgence. It is a sense indulgence. Look at this a little more deeply in connection with the meditative practices which are related to entering into the different deep states of consciousness. The jhanas, as we say in Buddhism, the avasthas, as we say in Hindu yoga, the deep states of contemplation, of the contemplative orders of the Christian and other mystics. Throughout all these religious teachings, you will find it distinctly taught. Don't attempt this, because it gives you pleasure. because it is a retreat, an escape from an irksome duty now, because it is a way of excusing yourself from answering the call of distress. You see? I am not allowed to make a date with God and keep it if there is somebody else crying for help nearby. Now you see how the test comes. If, when there is the cry for help, I do not immediately, completely, totally respond to it with the excuse that, oh, I have a date with God, I am indulging my senses, pleasure senses. These are difficulties. And if I tried to keep that date with God when there's the cry for help, I will find that God is not at home. Do you know why? Because the whole of Him has gone into that crying creature who needs help. And I've run away from. Look deeply into this business about the senses and sense indulgence. Have no truck with all this nonsensical, intellectualist, half-witted fashion which has sprung up in this century, decrying all Victorian fuddy-duddy outlook.
The Victorians thought that those who preceded them were fuddy-duddies.
Just be clean, absolutely clean, true, pure. If you want to be worldly, be worldly. Don't meddle with transcendence. Otherwise, the meddler will inevitably suffer and break under it. It's too great a power to play with. You can play with fire, more or less with impunity. You dare not do with transcendence. Have we not seen in our own lives? Just think. Some of us perhaps are too young yet. But some of us are quite old enough through our own experience to have learnt certain things. In childhood, it is not difficult to have a sincere, heartfelt outgoing responding to the idea of God or transcendence or whatever it is. It sort of comes naturally to us. I know the psychologists can give all sorts of explanations, father figures, security, and all the rest of it. Yes, that's all true. But over and above that, and underlying it, is an extraordinary something which the brain doesn't know, but it is there. Then adolescence, difficulties, problems, intellect comes into play, arguments, difficult experiences, the sight and the knowledge of injustices and horrible things around one. Where is this fellow called God? What's all this about? You see? And if it is deep enough and strong enough and the struggle is great enough and one's own wisdom hasn't flowered sufficiently, then God and everything concerning God is just thrown out of the window. The baby is thrown out with the bathwater. But what happens? Somehow, this baby is always with us It never can get thrown out with the bathwater. Sooner or later, in some form or other, you may give up Christianity and it'll come back as Buddhism. You may give up Hinduism and it'll come back as Islam or whatever it is, you see. But it comes back. This baby is your own essential immortal being. You can't do anything against this omnipotent, invincible, unresisting infant God. Reality. Truth. So, he comes back. Emerges back again into consciousness. Why? Because after throwing him out, and I thought myself so clever and capable, day after day I discovered I was incapable. The utopia which I was going to establish is in ruins around me. In the worldly sphere, look at the totalitarians and their histories. Alexanders, Napoleons, Mussolinis, Hitlers, and the whole crowd. What they did was in ruins around them. In certain cases, in their lifetime. In other cases, quite soon after their death. Alexander's great empire. The empire of the Caesars. That lasted very long, true enough. It's the longest lasting empire as such, apart from the Chinese empires. And so forth, you see. So, what I, out of conceit, out of separateness, try to establish, and I try to establish it because I'm indulging my senses. My sense of power, my sense of ego. These are all senses. I'm indulging that. That is doomed to destruction, and it spreads pain and misery everywhere around. So one comes back to God, to truth, to purity, simplicity, beauty, loveliness, peace and happiness in the true sense. Some of us are fortunate, we come back to it. And here and now, this flower grows. Some of you at least have read and studied the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita of the Hindus. Where is the scene laid? On a battlefield. To whom goes the victory? To no one. Both parties are all killed off. Almost like in Hamlet, where everyone gets killed off, only in a different way. They're all dead, they're all gone. The great fight for the kingdom ends in complete desolation and destruction. But certain things have happened. Krishna delivers the supreme truth to his disciple Arjuna, who realizes that truth, performs his duty. After performing that duty, he meets with his death because he considered himself he had the pride to consider himself the supreme warrior of all warriors. So pride slew him, and so forth. See? But look at this as the story of our own life. Our world is the battlefield for our soul, where good and evil struggle against each other. I am myself the field of battle. The teaching is given by me myself to me myself on this field of battle. And that which comes to flower is the essential absolute you, the immortal you. The you which you can never grasp through desire or through any intellectual knowledge, but which is transcendence itself, the one total reality. This is the marvel of the whole thing, is it not? The marvel is in and through me, but not for me. Not to be possessed by me, not to be limited. I have to be the transparent, unresisting nexus through which transcendence flows in and out freely, blessing its own creation. And this is religion and religious living and the religious life. It will necessitate relinquishment, complete relinquishment of everything unessential for this. And because of the relinquishment, the renunciation of all worldliness is proceeding by itself. And as that renunciation of worldliness proceeds by itself, then the unworldliness, transcendence itself, suffuses this which previously obstructed such suffusion. And in that is your fulfillment, is man's fulfillment. So perhaps we are beginning to see why the great teachers stressed, emphasized this business about freedom from the indulgence of the senses, and taught and encouraged and insisted upon the cultivation and right use of the senses. Go into this very, very deeply. It's the whole story of the practice of the religious life. Understand this and you won't be hurt in treading, I'll use the conventional phrase, in treading the path. But don't understand this and all along the line one stumbles, one falls, one is bruised. One's heart is eaten away by this inner worm of frustrated desire. Be very careful of that. So watch. Be mindful. You know, Jesus, I have often and often quoted this. Jesus said, "Watch and pray, for ye know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh." And perhaps I may add to that, "For we know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man shall go away from our midst, and we be left alone."